Picture this, if you will. You're an otolaryngologist about to see a new patient referred to your clinic, a 52-year-old female who recently noted a bump on the front of her neck that moves when she swallows. She reports feeling well and energetic. She has no reports of problems with temperature regulation or skin and hair changes. Her periods were regular until about 2 years ago when they stopped completely. She has normal bowel movements. Her vital signs are normal, and on physical exam, you registered that the sounds of her voice and breathing are normal, with no evidence of dysphonia or stridor. But you can feel a nodule in the left lobe of her thyroid gland, with the rest of her thyroid grossly normal in size and texture. Her primary care physician ordered TSH and free T4 levels in anticipation of the appointment, which are normal. With the information you currently possess, what is the next step you will take in evaluating your patient's neck mass? And welcome to Audiobricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. Today, we'll be teaching you about how real clinicians work up disorders of the thyroid, but first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes Audiobricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all content you hear on this podcast. And if you've been holding off on checking this out, well, now we're running the Bricks Season Pass campaign. If you follow the link in the show notes below, you can get 3 months of Bricks for the price of one, or a full year of Bricks for the price of 3 months. And simply clicking on the link helps support Audiobricks and the work we do to bring you the podcast, so we'll be happy if you even just take a look. Anyway, after completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Contrast the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. 2. Differentiate between the types of thyroid masses. 3. Contrast how thyroid hormone levels vary in thyroid disorders. And 4. Compare the results of the radioactive iodine uptake scan and antithyroid antibody tests in thyroid disorders. In short, the purpose of this episode is to summarize the key similarities and differences in the signs, symptoms, lab tests, and radiographic studies to help you bring together your knowledge of thyroid disease. I'm going to organize this like clinicians do, starting with the presenting signs and symptoms and proceeding to the diagnostic workup. Let's do this. Part 1. What are the signs and symptoms of thyroid disorders? The clinical presentations of hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism vary. Most of the signs and symptoms are due to changes in the hormone levels themselves, but others are due to unique features of specific etiologies of hypo and hyperthyroidism. Now, distinguishing hypothyroidism from hyperthyroidism is usually pretty straightforward, since they're nearly polar opposites. Hypothyroidism is like Droopy Dog. Hyperthyroidism is Speedy Gonzales. Hypothyroidism is someone on heroin, whereas hyperthyroidism is like someone who just snorted a line of cocaine. Since thyroid hormones T3 and T4 are responsible for potentiating the sympathetic nervous system, thermogenesis, and increasing GI motility, hyperthyroidism causes symptoms like tachycardia, hyperreflexia, diarrhea, intolerance to heat, and sweating, whereas hypothyroidism causes exactly the opposite. The problem is, these are actually pretty common to a lot of different conditions. Like I mentioned earlier, even a patient high on cocaine or any other sympathomimetic drug might present with all of these symptoms. But one of the most specific features of hyperthyroidism is the combination of increased food take, but paradoxically, weight loss. Since one of the most unique features of T3 and T4 is to increase the basal metabolic rate of cells, this symptom cluster is pretty specific to hyperthyroidism, just like weight gain despite decreased food intake is pretty specific to hypothyroidism. Both hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism cause psychiatric changes that are more or less what you'd expect given the other symptoms. So, what sort of psychiatric changes would you expect from a person with hyperthyroidism? Well, since hyperthyroidism ramps up the sympathetic nervous system, also known as the fight-or-flight system, these patients tend to be anxious, manic, or even psychotic. Even those that don't fit into the category of a psychiatric disorder often experience hyperactivity and insomnia. Conversely, hypothyroidism causes lethargy, psychomotor retardation, and depression. But even though it seems like they should have completely contrasting symptoms, that are pretty intuitive if you understand the physiology, there are actually a handful of symptoms that are common to both hypo and hyperthyroidism. They just occur for different reasons. The most common symptoms common to both hypo and hyperthyroidism is menstrual irregularity and even infertility in women, and decreased libido and sexual dysfunction in men. And while both hyper- and hypothyroidism cause mostly predictable psychiatric changes, both can cause cognitive decline when the disorder is chronically untreated. Both can also cause muscle weakness. In hypothyroidism, this tends to be weakness of the proximal muscles of the limbs. In hyperthyroidism, cardiomyopathy is actually the most common. And while you might expect only hyperthyroidism to cause hypertension because of activation of the sympathetic nervous system, hypothyroidism also tends to cause hypertension through other mechanisms of increased peripheral vascular resistance. Finally, hypothyroidism causes a very specific sort of edema known as myxedema. Instead of fluid buildup in the extracellular space, it's increased extracellular matrix proteins. And the reason that's relevant is that with interstitial fluid, you can press on the edema and sort of push the fluid back into the lymphatic system. With myxedema, you can't, which is why it's called non-pitting edema. Now, myxedema is associated with every type of hypothyroidism, where the edema is most notable in the face, shins, and wrist. In the last one, it can often cause carpal tunnel syndrome from compression of the median nerve against the flexor retinaculum. But as it turns out, myxedema is also a feature of one of the most common causes of hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, by a completely different mechanism. And in Graves' disease, the myxedema is notable for collecting in the shins, called pretibial myxedema, and also in the orbit behind the eyeball, where it manifests as proptosis. And this can give patients a pretty dramatic praying mantis sort of look. Think Igor from Young Frankenstein. Lastly, it's important to know that hyperthyroidism causes a few unique features that don't exactly have an opposite symptom present in hypothyroidism. Hyperthyroidism can cause osteoporosis and peripheral neuropathy, but the most serious life-threatening feature of severe hyperthyroidism is tachyarrhythmias from potentiation of the sympathetic nervous system. Most commonly, this causes atrial fibrillation, but in thyroid storm, this can cause the frequently fatal ventricular tachycardia and ventricular fibrillation. Okay, so that was a lightning-fast but clinically focused breakdown of the presentation of hypo and hyperthyroidism. Now it's time for a knowledge check to make sure you're still with me. Which symptoms are common to both hypo and hyperthyroidism? The answer is menstrual irregularities and sexual dysfunction, cognitive decline, skeletal and cardiomyopathy, hypertension, and myxedema. These are all common to both hypo and hyperthyroidism. Part 2. What are the types of neck masses? Neck masses are a common feature of thyroid disease, and sometimes either the patient or physician's first indication of thyroid disease is when they notice the neck mass. What's more, the distinction of focal versus diffuse enlargement, also called nodules and goiters, can help the clinician narrow down the differential diagnosis. Goiters, or diffusely enlarged thyroids, can be divided into simple goiters, which are smooth, big ol' thyroids, and multinodular goiters, which basically have so many individual nodules that you get a lumpy thyroid that's diffusely enlarged. Simple goiters, again also called diffuse, can be seen in patients with no symptoms, as is common in patients compensating for iodine deficiency. It can also occur in patients with Graves' disease, or patients with any of the thyroiditides. Yes, that's the plural, look it up. It's important to remember that most simple goiters should be non-tender on exam, the notable exception being subacute granulomatous thyroiditis. So as you can see, patients with goiters can be euthyroid, hyperthyroid, or hypothyroid. It's important to remember that in the case of the thyroiditides, patients may initially become briefly hyperthyroid as the follicle destruction releases the preformed thyroid hormone, then become hypothyroid. Multinodular goiters occur when, instead of occurring diffusely, the hyperplasia occurs in discrete foci, interrupted by areas of microhemorrhage and necrosis. If the multinodular goiter overproduces thyroid hormone, it's called a toxic multinodular goiter, and the patient gets treated for hyperthyroidism. But while goiters rarely indicate cancer, with a single thyroid nodule, you have to worry a bit more. 90% of them are still benign, and in general, a hot nodule, or one that secretes excess thyroid hormone, is less likely to be malignant. Other clues that a nodule may be malignant are if the nodule is fast-growing and fixed to the surrounding tissues, or if there's ipsilateral lymphadenopathy. Patients with cancer may also present with new-onset voice hoarseness or vocal cord paralysis due to local invasion of the nerves and surrounding structures. Table 2 in the brick that corresponds to this audio brick summarizes the findings of the thyroid exam and compares and contrasts them amongst various thyroid disorders, so if you have your computer handy, go ahead and check this out if you can. For now, though, let's try a quick review question before moving on. Which disease typically causes a painful goiter? The answer is subacute granulomatous thyroiditis. Part 3. How do thyroid hormone levels vary in thyroid disorders? Serum T3, T4, and thyroid-stimulating hormone levels will change in different thyroid diseases. While these three labs are often the first ones ordered in the workup of thyroid disease, changes in thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH, are the most sensitive and reliable indicators of early thyroid disease. This makes the diagnosis of thyroid disease a little counterintuitive, since you might think that the levels of actual thyroid hormones are the most important things to look for. Now think back to endocrine physiology for a sec. When thyroid hormone levels T3 and T4 increase, what compensatory change do you expect in TSH? Increased levels of T3 and T4 cause feedback suppression of the anterior pituitary, which leads to decreased TSH. So, if the primary problem is hypersecretion of thyroid hormone, like with a hypersecreting thyroid adenoma, the lab finding that best confirms this diagnosis is decreased TSH. You gotta almost think of it backwards. And as it turns out, most of the time, thyroid disorders originate in the thyroid gland itself, unlike, for example, Cushing's syndrome, in which the problem usually starts one level up the endocrine axis in the pituitary. In other words, most of the time, both hyper- and hypothyroidism are primary disorders. So, what lab values will you see most commonly in patients with primary hypothyroidism? Remember, the most sensitive and specific lab finding would actually be increased TSH, but you'll usually also see decreased T3 and T4 levels. Now, what would you think if your patient had decreased TSH as well as decreased T3 and T4? Well, this cluster suggests that the patient has secondary hypothyroidism, caused by hyposecretion of TSH from the anterior pituitary. And by now, some of you may be getting a little irritated, thinking, why do I have to even look at the TSH? What's wrong with just getting the T3 and T4 levels? I get you, it is a bit irritating, since in most cases, TSH is basically just opposite day for T3 and T4. But in patients with subclinical disease, namely slightly hyper or hypothyroid, but with minimal clinical complaints, the TSH will be abnormal even before the T3 or T4 will be. So when it comes to diagnosing thyroid disorders, just remember, keep your eye on the TSH. The one common situation in which TSH is actually unreliable is pregnancy. Due to increased levels of circulating carrier proteins, more T3 and T4 can be transported in the blood. As a result, the TSH is routinely lower than normal, even in clinically euthyroid patients. And due to changes in binding protein concentrations, the levels of measured T3 and T4 aren't reliably predictable either. Then there's a phenomenon known as euthyroid 6 syndrome, a set of thyroid function abnormalities in critical illness without a dysfunctional thyroid present. In this condition, only the T3 level, not T4, is decreased, and this is thought to be due to downregulation of peripheral deiodinases in critical illness that normally convert the circulating T4 to the more bioactive T3. Finally, a common situation you may encounter in clinic is a patient on synthetic thyroid hormone analogs to treat hypothyroidism. Laboratory monitoring is critical in these patients, since overtreatment and the resulting thyrotoxicosis can actually be pretty dangerous. Now, if you know that levothyroxine, a synthetic thyroid hormone analog, works like T3 and T4 in the body but isn't, what do you think the TSH, T3, and T4 will look like in a patient who's being appropriately treated for hypothyroidism? In hypothyroidism, the levels of T3 and T4 are low, so you replace them with levothyroxine. And while the levels of T3 and T4 will still be low, the cells in the body, including those in the anterior pituitary, respond to levothyroxine as well. So appropriate treatment of hypothyroidism is assumed if there is a normal TSH level. If you're overtreating the patient, the TSH will be low. And if you're undertreating the patient, the levels will be high. Part 4. How are radioactive iodine uptake and antithyroid antibodies used in diagnosis? If either the physical exam or thyroid function test indicate a problem with the thyroid, ultrasound or CT of the neck with IV contrast can be used to visualize the structures and often help with diagnosis purely based on structure. But there are three specific tests that can help distinguish the thyroid disorders more specifically. First, the radioactive iodine uptake, or RAIU scan. Second, serologic testing for anti-thyroid antibodies. And third, microscopic evaluation of thyroid tissue. The RAIU scan looks a little bit like a PET scan or a HIDA scan. If you've seen one, basically it's a white background with a very grainy image made up of coarse grayscale pixels that range from off-white to dark black. And what those pixels represent are the places where the radiotracer accumulates. For the RAIU, a radiotracer of iodine is used, since this element biologically accumulates in the thyroid to incorporate into T3 and T4, and it accumulates fastest in regions where thyroid hormone synthesis is taking place rapidly. This scan is helpful for both quantifying the level of thyroid activity and for determining the pattern of uptake when the gland is overactive. In a normal thyroid, the tracer should accumulate diffusely in the thyroid, and the RAIU scan will show what appears to be a grainy gray image of the thyroid on a white background. By capturing the tracer uptake at a specific amount of elapsed time after the injection of tracer into the bloodstream, it's possible to quantify the amount of thyroid activity by how dark gray the tracer accumulation appears on the scan. The darker the thyroid, the more active it is. In diseases like Graves' disease, where the entire gland is oversynthesizing thyroid hormone, the thyroid will appear uniformly much darker gray, or even black. In contrast, hypoactive thyroids will have substantially decreased uptake of tracer, since they're not synthesizing thyroid hormone as quickly, if at all. And this appears as an unusually light gray or even invisible thyroid on the RAIU. This is true of most diseases that cause hypothyroidism, including iodine deficiency and people who suppress their native thyroid by taking exogenous thyroid supplements. This is also true for every type of thyroiditis, and it's important to note that while these patients are often hyperthyroid early in the disease course, that excess hormone comes from ruptured follicles, not increased synthesis. So even if they're hyperthyroid, the RAIU will still in fact show decreased uptake. Thyroid nodules will only appear distinctly as dark gray or black on the gray of the thyroid if they're actively oversynthesizing thyroid hormones. And this is true for single adenomas or multinodular goiters. But in patients with a thyroid nodular mass, increased isotope uptake is, remember, more often seen in benign tumors. Low uptake, or cold nodules, have a higher likelihood of being malignant. So this test does not eliminate the need for a needle or incisional biopsy. The second test is the serology test for autoantibodies against various thyroid proteins, and these are detectable in both Graves' disease and Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Graves' autoantibodies are responsible for stimulating thyroid growth through activation of the TSH receptor, whereas there are many antibodies that can lead to Hashimoto's by either inhibiting or destroying the thyroid. Specific lab tests include TSH receptor antibodies in Graves' disease, TSH receptor blocking or antithyroid peroxidase antibodies in Hashimoto's, and the antithyroglobulin antibody that's, oddly enough, present in both Hashimoto's and Graves' disease. These assays aren't required in the evaluation of most thyroid disorders, but are helpful in some cases that are uncertain. In particular, the TSH-stimulating autoantibody for Graves' disease has sufficient sensitivity and specificity to where it can be used as an alternative for the gold standard RAIU in the diagnosis of Graves' disease, especially if the patient has concerns about ionizing radiation. Alright guys, time for a quick knowledge check. What type of antibodies cause the hyperthyroidism of Graves' disease? The answer is TSH-stimulating antibodies. And while this is the most sensitive and specific serologic test for Graves' disease, the antithyroglobulin antibody is also often found. The final specific modality used to diagnose thyroid disorders, specifically thyroid masses, is microscopic evaluation of thyroid tissue obtained by either fine needle aspirate, where you suck up a bunch of cells through a thin needle, core biopsy, where you use a big old needle to core out a thin cylinder of tissue, and excisional biopsy, where you surgically cut open the skin and cut out the nodule. Microscopic evaluation of thyroid tissue is generally used when thyroid cancer is a possibility, including those with irregular thyroid masses, solitary nodules, and goiter associated with symptoms like hoarseness or lymphadenopathy that can suggest local invasion or metastasis. Solitary nodules are most common, and cancer is found in about 5%. And that's our show. Let's go over what we learned about how to work up pathology of the thyroid. First, can you broadly describe how the presentations of hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism differ and how they're similar? For the most part, hypo and hyperthyroidism have opposing presentations. Hyperthyroidism presents with symptoms of a hyperactive sympathetic nervous system, increased GI motility, and an increased basal metabolic rate, while hypothyroidism presents with symptoms of a hypoactive sympathetic nervous system, decreased GI motility, and decreased basal metabolic rate. Some findings are seen in both hyper and hyperthyroidism, including menstrual irregularities and sexual dysfunction, cognitive decline, skeletal myopathy and cardiomyopathy, hypertension, and myxedema. Second, which lab test is the most sensitive for hypo or hyperthyroidism, and what two other basic lab tests can help narrow down the specific etiology of the thyroid disorder? Thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH level, is the most sensitive test for thyroid disease and can detect subclinical disease more reliably than measuring actual levels of thyroid hormone. TSH varies inversely with the level of thyroid activity in primary hypo and hyperthyroidism due to negative feedback. But T3 and T4 levels are still helpful in identifying the less common secondary thyroid disease, in which the main problem is with the secretion of TSH in the pituitary. In secondary hypothyroidism, low TSH secretion actually causes the T3 and T4 to decrease, and the opposite is true in secondary hyperthyroidism. Third, what is the clinical role of radioactive iodine uptake scintigraphy in the diagnosis of thyroid disease? The radioactive iodine uptake scan, or RAIU, demonstrates not only the magnitude of iodine uptake by the thyroid, which correlates with the level of active synthesis, it can also localize areas of focal increased activity, like thyroid adenomas and the foci of multinodular goiters. Finally, can you name four serologic tests used in the diagnosis of thyroid disease? TSH receptor stimulating antibodies are found in Graves' disease. TSH receptor blocking and antithyroid peroxidase antibodies are found in Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And antithyroglobulin antibodies are actually present in both Hashimoto's and Graves'. And that's it. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 52-year-old female recently noticed a bump on the front of her neck that moves when she swallows, and lab tests from her primary care physician reveal normal TSH, T3, and T4. How would you interpret this clinical information, and how would you proceed with the patient's workup? The patient's lab tests and lack of symptoms indicate that while she does have a thyroid nodule, she is euthyroid. Unfortunately, you tell your patient, while you might think it's better for the nodule not to mess up your hormone levels, a working nodule is less likely to mean cancer. A radioactive iodine test would not be indicated in this case, because it wouldn't help distinguish amongst the various types of nodules or tumors. So, you refer her for an ultrasound-guided fine needle biopsy to determine whether the nodule is benign or malignant. She looks worried, but you make an appointment to see her again next week, and you assure her that you'll discuss the results with her as soon as possible. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. And again, now's your chance to take advantage of the BRICS Season Pass offer by following the link in the show notes below. It's a huge discount on the written material that serves as the foundation of Audio BRICS, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. And help keep Audio BRICS free. Until next time, friends.